welcome to Data Science Perspectives. This series focuses on analytics and data science professionals from across industry to learn about how their career unfolded, what skills they look for when hiring, and what trends they think are coming next. I'm your host, Bill Franks. Let's get to it. Well, welcome to this episode of Data Science Perspectives. Today, we're going to be talking with Tim Berryman, the VP of Decision Sciences at Georgia Pacific Corporation here in Atlanta. I first met Tim several years back when he asked me to come and give a few workshops to him and his team at Georgia Pacific. He's lived in Atlanta for a number of years now and has, in fact, been with Georgia Pacific for nearly 25 years. So that's an accomplishment to be with any organization for that long these days. And he's really helped it grow over the years. As you'll see as we chat, Tim originally hailed from New Zealand, and he made his way to the U.S. Many years back to start in the gaming industry out in Las Vegas. His role at Georgia Pacific started out in the financial planning and analysis area, and he increased his span within the analytics space over time as the demand and application of analytics in Georgia Pacific grew. For the past several years, he's been the Vice President of Decision Analytics. If you're not familiar with Georgia Pacific, they do have a lot of brands you certainly know. Some of its best-selling consumer brands are products like Dixie, Brawny, and AngelSoft. And so with that, let's go ahead and welcome Tim to the show. Well, hey, Tim, thanks for joining me here on the show today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, one thing that's interesting I like about your background is, you started out in classic analytical roles, really in the financial planning and analysis space. And I know you've seen both your role as well as analytics in general evolve at Georgia Pacific over the years. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you've seen that evolution occur?
Yeah, and it's an interesting evolution where originally as an analyst sitting inside the organization, you were explaining what happened and why. It is a very time-intensive process. You're very dependent on the IT organization to deliver reports to you, and you were trying to glean some insights out of that. They control the report writing. As technology evolved, especially in the kind of business intelligence space, and you got BI platforms like Tableau and Power BI, the user-friendliness of this increased significantly, and now you're able to distribute that out to the masses. So we no longer have to pick up the phone and call IT and say, hey, can you write me a report? Now those you can get that information with the tip of your fingers. So that has certainly accelerated the speed to generating insights. At the same time, data started becoming much more readily available. And then you kind of get into the data science space, which has evolved quickly. And a couple of enablers around that were around the computing power, especially distribution within the cloud and with distributed processing. And the massive amount of data you got start coming in. Before you were kind of really dependent on the transaction systems. Now you've got the internet and all the data you're gleaming from that. And then you've got this exponential growth with data coming from devices as well. So at the same time, you've got data science evolving a lot more. It wasn't that it wasn't there before, it's you just didn't have the data and you didn't have the compute power to actually leverage it. So now what you see is we're now getting into the predictive and the prescriptive action. So instead of just describing what happened and why, we are now predicting what's going to happen and actually prescribing an action they should take as a result of this. And then that kind of leads itself to increased automation that we're starting to see. You can take away decisions from humans from making these decisions because now you've actually been able to actually move to that prediction and recommendation phase as well.
Yeah, that's a big that ability to automate these days, I think, is one of the biggest trends and enablers that's really been facilitated through the big data era thus far. One thing I think folks who didn't already know you, like I did, would have picked up on is you've got a bit of an accent. So you're from halfway around the world in New Zealand. What originally ended up bringing you over to the U.S.?
So, I have got a bit of a weird accent. I'm sure they detected that. But after I graduated from college, I graduated with finance and accounting degrees. I pretty much caught a flight straight to Las Vegas, believe it or not. So the reason I went to Vegas, actually had a brother that lived there and he had a company. So what motivated me to come on over was, well, let's go try something new, something different. Getting out of college is a unique time to go do it. And so I started working for my brother's company for a short period of time. Then he left the company, he sold it, and then I kind of stayed on in Vegas for a number of years, and I've moved around a lot since. But really, it was that motivation to experiment, to get into a new environment. Kind of hard leaving your friends and family halfway around the world, but it was certainly looking forward to the challenge working in a completely new country, in a lot of ways, a new culture as well.
I don't suppose you were ever in any of the big shows at any of the casinos in your time in Las Vegas.
Not sure you know this one, but I used to work at Caesar's Palace.
Oh, wow.
I was a financial analyst at Caesar's Palace, so I was doing kind of that financial planning analysis for them. And so I'm pretty familiar with the gaming industry. I did that for a number of years, and very interesting industry, doing pro formas on customers and a lot of other things, and understanding the probabilities on the games and the statistics behind that. And even I started building out and coding some stuff myself to predicting how much we'd win off certain high rollers. So yeah,
You know, it's
I had a lot
funny.
of experience in that industry.
The casino industry is the only one I know that actually values customers not by what they actually made you, but by, the odds of what they should have made you, right? In other words, the theoretical value of if I make a certain bet 10 times, I could have been the lucky one who won $1 million, but they don't count that as $1 million for me. They count it as whatever that, I would have been expected to be at 95 cents after playing that game 10 times. I always found that fascinating about gaming.
Yep, for sure.
So, one thing I know at Georgia Pacific, you ended up having, as many companies do, the age-old debate: how are you going to organize? What's the best structure? And at least for the time being, you've kind of landed on a center of excellence type model. What helped drive that decision in your all's specific situation?
So we started this journey 4 years ago, and it started with our CFO kind of having the foresight to say, now, he saw the kind of advanced analytics, AI and ML starting to come into play. And his challenge, he was thinking through, well, how do I identify those use cases? How do I start applying that technology to the problems that we have in the organization? So what we did, we gathered together a lot of leaders across the organization, and the CFO was a sponsor for this, and he said, okay, how are we going to structure this? What's our vision going to be? What's our operating model going to be? So one of the things that came to mind as we started thinking about this was, how do we kind of create value from this? If we want to drive BI, if we want to drive AI and ML in the organization, we had some mental models we came back with. One was, we're a very large company. We've got 15 different business units, very siloed. But our belief was leveraging things like artificial intelligence could be scaled across multiple business units. And really, to do that effectively, the best approach was to create a center of excellence around that. We didn't want 15 different groups starting to form their own capability. We wanted to have a much more coordinated approach. And it's worked out to be true. 80 plus percent of the projects we work on today, AI and ML, we have found other relevant use cases in other business units. So we've got a unique perspective on sitting across them all. And to be able to say, yes, this business unit will benefit from it. It's a customer churn problem. I solved it for one business unit, but I know several other business units with a lot of churn as well, and that problem would be applicable to them. So that was one of the biggest drivers on the scalability and potential for it. And the other one is, it's data science is a very scarce commodity right now, and it's difficult, hard enough to find by itself. But if you want to really grow an organization, a center of excellence is a good way to attract talent because they've got a logical career path. They can grow in an area they've got passion with. If you have one data scientist or two sitting in a business unit and you've got nowhere really to grow, it's going to be a challenge retaining talent. So that was another factor as well. So we landed on that one as a center of excellence. Now that may change over time, but for right now, it's proved to work out for us.
Excellent. One thing I find interesting too is with the whole COVID crisis the last year and a half, different companies and organizations have had vastly different types of impacts from that. And I know, given your focus in some of the very paper goods that were all but impossible to find at certain points in the crisis, from an analytical perspective and a business perspective, your challenges were actually somewhat different than people might expect, right? Were you having more trouble actually being able to keep up with all the demand that you all had and tracking how to meet that demand as opposed to other companies that were struggling to find the demand that was out there?
Fortunate for us, we had a lot of demand was accelerating significantly from your toilet paper to paper towels, or even to our building products, your 2x4s and your lumber, and even our boxes. We supply one a big supplier to Amazon for your boxes. So a lot of the channels we compete in, the demand was massive, and we couldn't keep up. That certainly created some challenges. And even where we had some models, AI models in place, we actually had to pause them. We hadn't been able to train these models in that sort of environment. We had such massive amounts of volatility and increases in demand. So we had to put a brake on some of those, and we had to retrain them to get used to that sort of volatility as well. So that was definitely a challenge, and a challenge for the workforce. Even for my own team, where having that customer interaction and relationship is important. Now we were working 100% from home, and we still are. And if you've got those relationships, you can still manage through it. But you've got new employees who you haven't even met yet in your organization. Harder for them to develop and grow as well. So, and relationships and understanding business priorities is very, very important to the role that we're in. So it's been a bit of a challenge, and we're looking forward to getting back a bit more than we have in the past in the next, 2 to 3 months.
I'll tell you mentioned a really important point that I don't think gets the credit that's due. We all talk about ongoing, you have to monitor your models and make sure they're not drifting in terms of slight, over time needing to be retrained or retuned. But the idea that when there's massive disruption, you might literally have models that are simply not relevant to that current environment and have to turn them off. For all the planning we have to turn things over to models, you actually have to have some backup plans. What if we had to take this over? Who's going to actually do this if the model turned off? And that's a huge challenge in and of itself, I imagine.
Yeah, and we have a separate team just focused on kind of model ops, which is really the management of the models. And so we've got a separate team monitoring all the models we deploy. We're monitoring for the quality of the data feeding into the models. We're monitoring for the accuracy, the performance of the models themselves. And probably the most important thing we monitor is the business outcomes. So if we deploy a model and it's around customer churn, are we actually churning less because of this or not? And so we have a whole team, and we have automatic alerts set up when things fall outside certain ranges that we've set up for all the models we deploy. But no, that is absolutely critical. The model's only good as the data it's trained on. If you give it a, if you expose it to an environment that it's not used to or hasn't seen before, then it's probably not going to work too well.
It's funny, my earliest exposure to that concept was way back in the 90s when I was working at IRI. And I know in Europe, in the consumer goods and retail space, people are familiar with IRI and Nielsen, and we were building pricing and promotion models and then giving companies simulation tools to see what would happen if I changed certain price or did certain promotion. And what we had to build into those tools was what's the minimum and maximum you're allowed to look at. So in other words, if all our models were built off price changes in the plus 15 to minus 15 range, we wouldn't even let you simulate something at minus 30 or plus 30, because to your point, it's so far out of the range of what was seen, you just don't know if it's going to apply. And I think that's an old classic rule that I believe still applies as much as ever, even though some of the models we're using might be more sophisticated and might be using different types of data like images and so forth. There's still a point where you've got to keep your deployment using data in the general range of whatever you created the models with, or you're really kind of playing with fire.
Yep, absolutely.
So you're unusual these days only in the sense that you've had a nice, long, successful career at one large company. There's so many more people that end up switching jobs around. What's one of the things that you think has led you to be able to be successful over all these years at Georgia-Pacific? What's one or two of the traits that you found has really helped you?
Well, first of all, I love to solve problems. Now, AI ML as an example is just another mechanism to go do that. But I've always had a passion to solve different problems. And that passion is very important. If you don't have that passion, you probably need to look at something else, because you really what that helps me identify where I want to succeed as well. And the other thing that's really important is focusing on creating value for your customers, internal and external, whoever they may be, helping them be successful. So truly understanding what your customers' needs and wants are. And it's not just about creating insights for the sake of insights, not just creating reports. It's about how do I turn those insights into profitable actions. And when you start doing that and you start creating success for your customers, that kind of happens naturally for you. A couple of other things I found very useful is kind of listening more and talking less, really understanding what the problem is, understanding what their needs are. And for me, it was like picking a company that aligns with my own personal values, one that is that seeks rewards you for the value you create, and it's not really political in nature. So I found one reason I certainly stay with the company as long as I have. And another one is kind of don't discount the importance of relationships. As you move up in the organization, the more you need to influence others to get work done. It may not be and may be outside your control. So those relationships are going to be critical as well. So again, kind of like making sure you have a passion for what you want to go work with and work in. For me, it was solving problems, and this is just another mechanism to do that. Then finding companies that align with your values and really understanding what your customer needs and wants are at the same time.
You know, it's interesting. I can imagine the advantage you have in the sense of, back to a number of the things you mentioned, relationships. You've been there a couple decades. You literally know pretty much everyone who's been around, and your focus on understanding what your business partners need and what their motivations are. I could imagine, new people that come into the company and start find that as much or more about their business than even some of the people on their own team, and as you're able to recommend analytics. So I definitely. The upside to those longer tenures is the ability to do those very things that you mentioned. So I can see how that played out for you. What's one thing you wish somebody had told you before you started working that you had to learn the hard way on the job?
That your learning has just begun. You graduate from college, you're confident in your technical skills, but this is such a lifelong journey. And there's been studies on this. I think it was like 37% of what you learn of what you learn is not actually used within your formal studies. So it is a really a lifelong journey of learning in an area that you're passionate about. And a lot of the learnings come from doing, refining, and improving what you work on. And some of those best learning experiments come from your mistakes and your ability to change and avoid those from happening in the future. So the one thing I wish they gave me a heads up on was, boy, you've only just started to accumulate the knowledge you need to be successful, and you're going to have to put a lot of time into that lifelong learning. And most of that learning is going to come outside of your college and your formal education.
Yeah, I think folks in roles like yours now, it's almost like being a parent a little bit. You're going to hire some fresh young whippersnapper out of school, and you can tell that they think they know everything, and they don't, but they don't know that yet. And it's almost just like a parent letting a kid learn. You almost have to say, okay, they're going to make a mess here at some point, but without them making that mess, they're not going to understand that they don't know everything. So, I'm sorry. Well, speaking of students then, and coming in fresh in the work environment, what are some of the traits or skills you'd look for today if you were going out and hiring someone either with no experience right out of school or very little experience a year or two out of school?
So the first thing we look for is a culture fit. So even if someone doesn't have the best technical skills in the world, we can train them. But culture fit is critical for us, because you're somebody of good technical, really smart, with great technical skills, but their culture is not aligned to the company. That can be dangerous. So we're first looking for those values and that culture fit. So for us, those values are things like integrity. Have you got humility? Or you're one of those people who always thinks they know everything. Are you looking to continually transform yourself? Because in this environment, change is faster than is any other point in time in history. Are you going to be able to treat others with dignity and respect? Are you open to challenge? Are you willing to challenge others? and seeking out the best knowledge. And you've got to have a passion for what you do. So that whole culture fit is, and your values have got to align with what we want to hire as a company. So that's like tick mark number one. And when you start getting into the skills, soft skills are critical. If you want to communicate effectively, if you can't communicate effectively, that's really going to limit your career. So we are looking for soft skills in our organization. And then kind of third is that around the technical skill side. So it obviously depends on your role, but areas like Python and SAS are important to us, and having a statistics background is helpful, having a computer science background. So that will vary depending on the role that you go into. But that culture fit and those soft skills are definitely two areas a lot of people don't think about, but that's what we are hiring for first. And then the technical skills comes after that for the role.
You know, it's really amazing. I mean, to me, it's not a surprise, but it's how consistently executives always rate the technical skills below the soft skills. And I think students make a big mistake oftentimes, and even people earlier in their career, or technical people in general, of thinking it's all about those technical skills. And you know, the force with which you made that point, I hope people out there pay attention, because it's you know, that's a big distinction, you know, just between someone saying, if you can come and program like heck for us, you're good, and, well, that's nice, but we need you to do other things. And I think, you know, what you're saying is, you're definitely not in the just come and code for us category.
Exactly. And one other thing on that I'd quickly mention is people don't realize when you hire somebody too, it is much easier to teach them the technical skills versus trying to change their values. So maybe they're brought up in a culture where they don't treat people with dignity or respect, or they always think they're the smartest person in the room. To change that and change somebody's personality and how they develop themselves, very, very difficult to change. It's much easier to teach somebody the technical skills to be the technical skills side of it. So I don't think people really realize that's kind of one of the reasons you go after that, because it's very hard to change somebody's kind of values and virtues relative to the technical skills.
It's interesting, because I think that's a great distinction too. It's not just the soft skills, which you also mentioned, but those values and that match of those values, because that's a great point. I mean, even at age 20, you're pretty set in your ways. I find it hard to imagine any company be able to make too many substantial changes to, you know, my general way of looking at the world today. I've been around a little too long now, and I'm a little too set in my ways. I'll be you know, the first to admit it, but where I match a company, I think it could be great. So, you know, I guess to finish off then, as we look forward a couple of years now, what are one or two of the biggest trends you think are going to be impacting the world of analytics and data science in the coming years?
Yeah. Today, at least how it's being implemented inside the businesses, a lot of this AI is built around solving a narrowly defined problem. Maybe it's my customer churn, or maybe I want to improve my demand forecasting. I think that the big change we're going to start seeing is the future will be around these cognitive platforms that self-learn from their own environment. So what I mean by that is you've got these intelligence platforms that are ingesting information. They're ingesting information from like transactions that you've made in the past, from different research papers being published. They're learning from human behavior. They're learning from decisions that have already been made. Essentially, these cognitive platforms are becoming digital twins of your business. They're just ingesting massive amounts of diverse information. Could be structured data and databases, could be unstructured data like in pictures and photographs. So instead of AI just recommending an improved demand forecast, it is now monitoring your entire supply chain. I think the future is going to be about detecting anomalies, recommending courses of action. For example, should I purchase more supplies than I have in the past? And in some cases, or a lot of cases, it could be automatically implementing those actions without you having to be involved. So think of like self-driving cars as an example, where it's monitoring the environment around you and reacting to it. What we're heading toward is more a self-driving enterprise, where it's automatically acting and thinking in its own and making those decisions for you. So just think of like an Alexa. You're actually querying the intelligence layer for questions like, hey, I'm about to get a large order. When do you think you'll be able to deliver it? How can you reduce my working capital? How can I reduce employee turnover? So the way you actually Ingest insights is going to change as well. But this whole cognitive platform, where the best analogy I can think of, like a self-driving car, you've got a self-driving enterprise where it's detecting anomalies and it's making those decisions for you, or giving you opportunity to provide input into those decisions. And it's doing that self-driving within an enterprise perspective, instead of a very narrow defined problem set, like we often see the application today.
Well, I think you hit on a winning term there, self-driving enterprise. I love that. You need to write a blog or two on that and get your name attached to it, because I think people would love that. I think it's great, and I think it illustrates perfectly what you're talking about. So, thanks for that example. That's a new one for me. So, hey, I know we've taken a lot of your time already. I want to thank you so much. I know you're busy, and I think your insights here will be tremendously valuable for everyone who takes a listen to the webcast. So, thanks so much, Tim.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks.